Last 5% Media.
On this podcast, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. In addition, historical audio and original interviews include outdated language to describe sex workers. Listener discretion is advised. On October 18, 1977, an employee of the Mid-City Granite Company discovered a body in the weeds, a few yards from a road leading to Forest Lawn Cemetery. He told his boss, who called the Los Angeles Police Department. LAPD Detective Bill Williams was about to end his shift when the Hollywood Division got the call.
It was probably 3:30, 4 o'clock. The desk officer came in and said, "We have a call. There's a dead body on Forest Lawn Drive."
He grabbed his gear and headed out. When he got there, he couldn't see the body from the road. He had to walk a few yards past a rock pile down into a gully. There he found the body of a young black woman lying face down. Except for her earrings and a broken pendant necklace, she had nothing on. I'm Joseph Redotta. I first encountered this story many years ago in my former career as an opposition researcher. That's like a private investigator who works on political campaigns. 30 years ago, my job was to learn everything about a candidate for governor of California, the sitting attorney general, and find a way to take him down. My starting point was the Hillside Strangler murders.
Most of the strangler victims were found in the hills surrounding Los Angeles, often near freeways or in ravines. The victims were mostly teenagers and young women.
In this podcast, I'll revisit 10 homicides that terrorized Los Angeles in 1977 and 1978.
The Los Angeles police don't know if they're looking for one killer or for several.
We'll follow an ambitious prosecutor as he gambles with his political future.
My lawyers had come to me and said, "We don't think we have enough. The major witness has gone south."
And we'll go inside the jury room as 12 men and women decide the fate of a killer.
But I looked at him really hard, and I just felt icy, icy cold.
When I returned to this case 30 years later, I pulled my files out of an archive at Stanford University. I didn't know it at the time, but someone else was looking into the Hillside Strangler case for a very different reason.
Would my life have been better if, like, I would have never known?
From Last 5% Media, this is Hillside. Chapter 1, Like a Machine.
My goals were to be a college professor, spend my summers in Europe, drive a sports car, and write a book in Paris during the summer. And I didn't belong in this world, but that's where I was.
This is Dr. Lois Lee. In the 1970s, she was living in L.A. and working on her Ph.D. in psychology.
The streets of Sunset Boulevard were packed with prostitutes.
In 1976, the LAPD Hollywood Division made more than 4,000 arrests for prostitution, 10 times the rate in the rest of Los Angeles. Cops called the area Hookerville. This is where Lois Lee crossed paths with a young woman who made an impression.
I met Yolanda Washington on Sunset in Detroit in 1977, probably early in the year.
Yolanda was 18. She and her older sister shared an apartment near the Los Angeles International Airport. In the spring of 1977, Yolanda met a man in the laundry room of her building. Things started to go wrong for her after they began dating. Her sister later described his boyfriend to the Los Angeles Times as a pimp and a narcotics dealer. She moved out. The rest of Yolanda's family pulled away from her, too. She didn't answer directly when her mother asked her how she earned a living. Her father told her she wouldn't be worth a plug nickel by the time she was 25. Yolanda eventually gave up the apartment. She had no fixed address. Sometimes she stayed in cheap motels in Hollywood. That's where she first met Lois Lee.
And that was the time I was on the streets and the police pulled up. And Yolanda was particularly scared because she was not supposed to be hanging out with other girls.
Safety in numbers didn't apply here.
because if you're together, you're more likely to get stopped by the police. They were supposed to be working independently. So I put them all in my car. I had a little tiny sports car, and I took the girls, dropped them all off in different corners so they wouldn't get in trouble.
In September 1977, LAPD arrested Yolanda Washington and charged her with prostitution. Another sex worker called Lee to ask if she could help find Yolanda a lawyer or talk the cops into giving her a break. By the time the grad student got to the police station, there was nothing she could do.
And Yolanda had already pled guilty, and they'd given her 10 days in jail. They let me talk to her. I says, call me when you get out. I'll help you. I never heard from Yolanda.
On the night of October 17, 1977, Ron Lemieux was at his music shop at the corner of Sunset and Detroit in Hollywood. As he was closing for the night, through the shop window, he saw a black woman in handcuffs and a young white man with curly hair and a mustache push her into the back seat of a car driven by another man. Lemieux figured it was just undercover cops arresting another hooker. He closed his shop and headed home. He wouldn't think about that moment again until he saw a man on the evening news 15 months later.
This is one particular, like, vivid memory I have. I actually thought I was a different nationality than what I was.
This is Mika Mercado. Her father, Emilio Mercado, was born in Honolulu.
My mom's mom told me that I was Hawaiian.
In 1977, his father was living in Maui, and his grandparents lived in Hilo on the Big Island. But the rest of his family lived in California. They were Filipino.
And I remember being in grade school, and it was a Hawaiian kid. He was a Hawaiian kid, and he would share his culture. And I remember saying, I'm Hawaiian too, you know? And then I even remember the kid challenging me, like, no, you're not.
Mika has no memory of her father, but she does remember a birthday party. Her dad's family was there.
They were at my birthday party, I just remember them being, like, really emotional and, like, kind of weird. And they were like, do you remember? Do you know who we are?
They hadn't seen Mika in a long time. She remembers they were very emotional.
Because how I looked, because my clothes were, like, raggedy and small, and I wasn't being taken very good care of.
Mika saw this side of her family a few more times.
I remember times that my mom's mom would let me go see them. It would be situations of using me to get money from them. So they would, you know, take me shopping or get things, you know, and then send me back. And then I just remember just feeling very just awkward. And then it, like, the relationship kind of, they disappeared again. And I don't know if that was on their end. Like I said, I always just kind of felt like, you know, forgotten about.
In October 2019, Mika was at a crossroads.
Honestly, because I just feel like my family that I have now sucks. So I just said it would just feel really cool to maybe have some more blood out there, that I feel like I've gone as far as I can go with the family that I have now, and it's not going anywhere.
She decided it was finally time to learn more about her father. She signed up for an account at a genealogy website. Her imagination went wild as she took this first step.
What if I'm, like, related to royalty and I'm, like, a princess somewhere or something? Like, that would be, like, pretty cool. But I don't know. Yeah, that's just a little kid in me. Like, like, maybe my family owns, like, this big island somewhere, this big property, and I can go claim it, you know, and...
But her real goal was to find a new family.
So I feel like if I can find, you know, an extension of my dad and maybe build something there, like maybe I have aunts and uncles and maybe they have kids, and that would be my cousins. And then I could find out about my dad's family and see what's up there. Like, it's gotta be something good. Like, positive, gotta be something, like, nice.
At her computer, Mika typed in her father's name, Emilio Mercado.
And then from there, it started linking me to different information, specifically newspaper clippings and articles.
Then she typed in another name, the name of the first Hillside Strangler victim, Yolanda Washington.
Okay, can I ask you one favor?
Yeah, of course.
I'm hard of hearing.
Oh, okay.
Okay, after all the years of gunshots and stuff?
Yeah,
seriously.
Yeah. Should I?
So if you just speak up a little on the questions, yeah.
This is Frank Salerno, a retired detective with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department.
I was assigned to the Homicide Bureau. That was way before CSI and all the things you see on TV now. My partner and I were next up in rotation for the next murder case that came in.
In La Crescenta, a quiet suburban town in the San Fernando Valley, an electrical contractor noticed something as he backed out of his driveway early in the morning. It was the body of a young girl lying on a patch of ice plant in his front yard. He went into a shed and grabbed a tarp to cover the body so the neighborhood children wouldn't see it as they walked to school. Then he called the LA County Sheriff's Department. Detective Salerno arrived soon after.
Right away, it was obvious it was a murder because you could see the ligature mark already on her neck. So she had been strangled.
The victim had clear indentations. Investigators call these ligature marks on her ankles and wrists.
She looked like she'd been placed in the position she was in. The ice plant or the plant material that she was laying in came up over a short curb that separated the parkway from the street. There was no sidewalk. Down by her feet, in that area where her feet would be, that ice plant or plant material had been tufted up or pulled up like somebody tripped over it. But that was another thing that just stuck in my head.
Along with one more detail.
The only thing around her body was a tuft of white fiber on her eyelid. And it was no bigger around than the tip of your finger, right above her eye, right on the eyebrow. And I physically removed it with my fingers and put it in a, we used to carry small envelopes and things for evidence, put it in that, marked it, and then eventually transported it to the crime lab for analysis.
By this time, I was a pretty experienced homicide investigator on my own right.
That's Jim Mitchell, a longtime reporter for one of LA's all-news radio stations. He's retired now, living with his son in Northern California. In October 1977, Jim's home was in La Crescenta, blocks from where the electrician had placed a tarp over the young woman.
And I got a call from my station, and they said, on your way in, will you check? We've got this report of a dead body in somebody's front yard. So I drove over there and checked out the scene very quickly. And it was a bizarre scene. Her body was on display and in a very sexualized position like that. This was obviously not just a dump. Somebody had intentionally arranged this girl.
At the crime scene that morning, Jim introduced himself to the detective.
I had not met Frank before, and I was just simply surveying the scene as much as anything else. And I turned to Frank, and I said to him, I said, have you ever seen anything like this before? And he said, no. And I said, I bet you we're going to see a lot more. And he said, yep.
I really didn't have an idea of where we were going to go with her as far as where we were going to find out she came from. When we eventually found out it was Hollywood, it wasn't a surprise. She fit the lifestyle that we learned she was living.
Hollywood High School couldn't hold on to Judy Miller after she turned 15. She was tiny, about 5'1", just 91 pounds, with reddish-brown hair. Although some press reports described her as a prostitute, her friends told a more complicated story of a girl who found a makeshift family on the streets and occasionally turned a trick for a bed or a hot dog. She was tough and streetwise, a friend told the Los Angeles Times, and added, she wouldn't go with anybody she didn't know. Early on the morning of Halloween, 1977, Judy was hanging out at Carney's, a diner inside a vintage Union Pacific rail car parked on Sunset Boulevard. She was with a man she knew casually. That man later testified he watched Judy walk back and forth across the parking lot. Before long, a dark blue car pulled in, and Judy spoke to the driver. The man saw Judy get into the front seat on the passenger side. It was about 1:30 in the morning. He saw the car head east on Sunset Boulevard. He didn't see what happened next. The car turned right and stopped, and another man got in. Detective Salerno's first task was to identify Jane Doe number 89.
She remains unidentified for 10 days. But in the first two or three days, we checked all missing person reports of young people throughout LA County. We may even check some of the surrounding counties just to see if there was a female that matched her description that was missing and that we could go with. She was very tiny, and she had very bad teeth. I mean, exceptionally bad teeth. They stood out. One of our initial thoughts was obviously, if we could, put her picture in the paper. We had one of our staff artists come in, and he did a drawing of her.
The LA Times ran that drawing on page 4 under the headline, Public's Aid Sought. Tips poured into the sheriff's office.
A number of them would have a first name, Judy. I know this girl, Judy. She hangs out in Hollywood. We might even have been told she was a runaway from the anonymous, some were anonymous callers. We went to, there's a small little park. A lot of kids hang out there, a lot of runaways. We showed them our composite, and a number of them said, that's Judy. Judy who?
She was making most of her living through prostitution.
Jim Mitchell, the radio reporter, also set out to learn more about the girl.
She had had a couple of jobs that were kind of, I think one time she worked as, she worked in a drugstore, nothing more. And she was basically on the streets. And I got to learn a little bit about street life. It was basically a real attraction at the time, not quite the same as Haight-Ashbury. This was more Southern California oriented, obviously. A lot of drug use, and they were mostly living outside. It was difficult, first of all, to get people, to find people who knew her. And then it was very difficult to find people, even when they knew her, who were willing to talk about her because she was a murder victim and they didn't want to get tied up in it.
I've always had a sense of intrigue, you know, and specifically about serial killers, and a lot to just get an understanding of that psyche. You know, because it's like, I know it sounds strange because you would think that I probably would not want to go there.
This is Mika Mercado again. When she started her online research in October 2019, she set out to learn more about the Hillside Strangler's first victim, Yolanda Washington.
One would say, yeah, with technology being what it is and how much is available to us, why I didn't try to do it sooner. I think it was just one of those things that's maybe a little bit scared of the unknown. Me being so used to tragedy was being afraid, would it be more like dead ends or would it be more harm than good, you know? And then finally, I just, you know, decided to just go ahead and start seeking things out. I was ready to do it.
She found an article from the Los Angeles Times dated December 5th, 1977. It describes the short life of Yolanda Washington, her estrangement from her family, her unfortunate association with a troubled boyfriend, and her brutal murder.
I had seen some, of course, and knew about some of them, but this particular article I had never seen.
A photograph accompanies the article.
And what pissed me off is because my family lied and said they never did that. That they never did that article.
Two black women sit on a couch. Yolanda's sister is on the left. She's in her early 20s, wearing a dark scarf around her head, jeans, and a dark top with white lettering. I can make out the letters A-R-T. Next to her is an older woman, Yolanda's mother. She's wearing glasses, a white scarf, and a top with a bright pattern.
They didn't even know what I was talking about, that it didn't exist.
Sitting on the older woman's lap is a little girl. She's 2.5 years old.
And then you're looking at it right in your face, like you straight out lied.
Lisa Kasten was born and raised in Los Angeles. She lived in Hollywood, worked part-time at her father's real estate office, and had just started a second job at a natural foods restaurant called Health Fair. She was 21.
One of the things I really appreciated about Lisa was that she was very intuitively aware of her surroundings. I didn't have to look out for her. She could look out for herself.
This is one of her best friends, Yana Nirvana.
She was very generous-hearted and very open-minded. And she was also very quick to figure out who was a creep and wanted something else from her.
At about 9 o'clock the night of Saturday, November 5th, 1977, less than a week after Judy Miller died, Lisa finished up her shift at the restaurant. She changed out of her waitress uniform and put on dark corduroy pants, a diamond-striped sweater, and a light jacket. Lisa walked with a co-worker to her convertible VW Beetle parked just 2 blocks away. From there, she drove to her apartment on Argyle Street in Hollywood and parked. The next day, a manager at Health Fair knew something was off when Lisa didn't show up for her shift. He contacted Lisa's mother, who tried to reach her daughter through friends with no luck. She called her ex-husband, who went to check on Lisa. As he drove, he heard a report on the radio.
Glendale police have another apparent murder of a young woman on their hands. KFWB's Cecilia Pedroza has a direct report from Chevy Chase Drive.
When he got to Lisa's building, her father asked the manager to let him inside her apartment with a passkey. From inside the apartment, he called the Glendale police and told them he had heard the radio report. The father described Lisa and mentioned she had 3 piercings in one of her earlobes. An officer with the Glendale Police Department suggested that the father come to the station right away. There, through a closed-circuit television monitor connected to the coroner's office, he viewed the face of the young woman who had been found. When the father said he couldn't be sure, he called his ex-wife, who went to the station and identified the murdered young woman as their daughter.
We get a call from the coroner's office, I believe, and they tell us about another female that's been brought into the coroner's office.
Lisa Kasten had ligature marks around her neck, wrists, and ankles, nearly identical to the marks on Judy Miller.
We pulled both bodies out and put them side by side on their separate gurneys. Dr. Joe Choi was our pathologist. And Joe looks at him, and we see what, you know, we're observing what we have. And he said, looks like they came out of a machine.
From the moment Detective Bill Williams saw the body in a rock pile off Forest Lawn Drive, he knew there was something different about this case.
The fact of the tattoos and so on, she's not your soccer mom type, and just her appearance. And I'd seen enough of the girls working the streets when I was out looking for snitches. They're probably the best sources for information you can find. And so her appearance sort of fit in with that.
There were signs of strangulation, marks on the victim's neck. There were also marks around her wrists.
There was definitely ligatures that were maybe a quarter of an inch wide, and looked pretty distinct.
Detective Williams searched case files looking for similar victims, anyone strangled and left out in the open in the same manner, what cops call an M.O., modus operandi.
You know, we didn't have the computer search would could put in an M.O. and come up with something. I went through reports back to the first part of the year, see if there was anything similar, and there wasn't.
Pretty quickly after that, LAPD identified the body of Jane Doe number 85. Her fingerprints matched those of a woman arrested in September for prostitution, Yolanda Washington. Detective Williams spoke to the LAPD Vice Unit, asking if anyone knew her or could connect him to anyone who did. A Vice detective gave him the name of her pimp. Williams recognized the name. He talked to him on an earlier case.
Then I went to night watch roll calls and told the story of Yolanda Washington and wanting to talk to her pimp. And if anybody stopped him or saw him on the street, to get good shake on him, good information, so I could get in touch with him.
In his experience as a detective for the LAPD, it was unusual for a pimp to murder a woman he put to work.
Because that's the income for a pimp. They don't want to kill them. They slap them around and get them in line. But, you know, why would you kill your income? That was a mystery. In today's television, they call him a person of interest, and that's basically what he was.
There was no doubt in our mind, we're looking for one killer for these two females.
Retired sheriff's detective Frank Salerno again.
At the time, law enforcement was really looking at serial murders, basically by M.O.
It was clear that Judy Miller and Lisa Kasten had died the same way, by strangulation. Both victims had nearly identical marks on their necks, wrists, and ankles. Maybe their killer had struck before. Detective Salerno scanned reports for similar cases and came across the name of Yolanda Washington.
I remember we were told by LAPD that there was a black female who was found over on Forest Lawn, and that had been prior to Judy Miller's body, a month or two, at least, before.
He reached out to Detective Williams, and they got together to compare notes. Williams was certain that whoever killed Judy Miller and Lisa Kasten had also killed Yolanda Washington. Frank Salerno wasn't so sure. On the one hand, Judy Miller's friends had shared with Salerno that she sometimes traded sex for money or a place to stay. Yolanda had spent 10 days in jail for prostitution.
Okay. Yes, she was a streetwalker, very definitely. She was a working girl.
But Yolanda Washington had ligature marks only on her neck and wrists. The other victims' marks were on their necks, wrists, and ankles.
There weren't really the five-point restraints, okay? So that was one thing.
And there was another difference. Judy and Lisa were white. Yolanda was black. The man who met Yolanda Washington in the laundry room of her apartment building in early 1977 became her boyfriend. News reports and trial testimony say he was also her pimp. As LAPD Detective Bill Williams began investigating Yolanda's murder, he tried to track down that guy.
I wanted to talk to the pimp because he may have been able to get a timeline going. Last time he saw her and location and that type of thing.
We understand today, because of circumstances, people are driven into that way of life. Substance abuse, alcohol, prostitution. But that didn't make her a bad person.
This is the man Detective Williams was looking for.
All I can say is she was a wonderful girl and a beautiful woman. She didn't deserve to die.
He now says that he and Yolanda were just friends, that he knew she earned money through sex work, but he wasn't her pimp. This conflicts with the trial record and what he told investigators at the time. the man attended Yolanda's funeral, her family was outraged.
I think they were thinking I had something to do with it. And I don't fault them for that. I mean, it's always the closest person if they suspect.
Detective Williams didn't think this man had killed Yolanda, but maybe he knew something about her last few hours that might help in the investigation.
Did they ask you if you were her pimp?
Well, it seems to me if that were the case, then I would have been in jail, don't you think?
I'm just questioning, did they ask you? Do you remember?
Probably they did.
He and Yolanda had a nightly routine. He would drop her off in the early evening somewhere along Sunset Boulevard between La Brea and Fairfax Avenues, a 16-block stretch of Hollywood, and he'd pick her up hours later. He said he last saw Yolanda in Hollywood on the night of October 17th, between 10:30 and 11. With two other women, she left a Denny's restaurant at Detroit Street and walked eastbound on Sunset. He shared what he knew with LAPD investigators.
I took a polygraph test, and they let me go.
Detective Williams didn't get what he was looking for.
No, he was worth it.
So it was nothing that they could ever keep that was like a secret from me. And then it's hard because I imagine they were going through pain, but they didn't talk to me about it.
Growing up, Mika Mercado heard whispering. Those conversations did not include her.
I always had the feeling of growing up that something was always like a secret. There was always like huddles going on and stuff like that.
As an adult, she came across an article in the Los Angeles Times from December 1977. The headline, "The First Victim, Once a Happy Life." Yolanda's mother showed little emotion as she spoke about her daughter. It was as if she was still dazed, the Times reported, by Yolanda's murder and everything that happened since. There's a photograph with the article. Two black women sit on a couch, Yolanda's sister and her mother. A little girl is sitting on the older woman's lap. The girl has a ponytail jutting out of the top of her head. The women are looking at the girl, but the girl is looking directly at the camera. Mika recognized the face in the photo.
I was told that didn't exist.
Yolanda Washington left behind a 2.5-year-old daughter. Her grandmother told the reporter the child seemed happy during the day, but at night she'd wake up crying and ask for her mother, and then she'd fall asleep again.
And to read that part where it said, "I wake up every night like asking for my mom."
Mika is that little girl. Hillside is a production of Last 5% Media. This podcast was created, written, and hosted by me, Joseph Rodota. Our executive producers are Chris George and Joaquin Alvarado. Caitlin Bruce is our producer. Adam Mellion is our research director. Cheryl Duvall is our editor. Julie Checkaway and Robert Saliday served as consulting producers. Our sound engineers are Jeremy Dalmas and Craig Thomas. Craig is also our composer. Edgar Guetta designed our logo and website. Special thanks to the Center for Inquiry Libraries in Buffalo, New York, the Hoover Institution Archive at Stanford University, the Mansfield Library at the University of Montana, and the Warnke Ranch Artist Residency. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and give us a positive rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. For information about this episode, visit our website, hillsidepodcast.com. And thanks for listening.